Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, our guest is Scott Stambach, author of his debut novel, The Invisible Life of Ivan Azenko.
Azenko.
And you know, I had it right. I had it perfectly. Azenko. I even wrote it phonetically. Okay.
Yeah.
Scott received his bachelor's degree in physics and philosophy from SUNY and his master's in physics from UC San Diego. He teaches physics and astronomy at Grossmont Mesa and San Diego City College. He also collaborates with Science for Monks, which is really cool. He's published in several literary journals, including Eclectica, Stirring, and Convergence, and Writing Disorder, especially Read the Siren Disappeared in Writing Disorder, which is as Gogolish as you can get. Think The Nose or The Overcoat. The Invisible Life of Ivan Azenko is a novel about lacking, about absence, about presence, love, beauty, and death. Ivan, who is 17 years old, is a survivor or a legacy of Chernobyl and is doomed to a lifelong residency in Mazar Hospital for gravely ill children. Not in the sense of Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children or a Narnia, but more in the sense of a gulag, or more succinctly, a hell. The beauty of the book is that out of despair, death, resignation comes this pure white lotus of hope, beauty, and love. The juxtaposition of these is what makes this book something special. Ivan has no legs, one arm, a thumb, and two fingers, and a drooping face that produces a slur of a voice. But inside, in his own universe, resides an astounding intellect, wit and mischief, and a bit of spite and malice. Lost, waiting for something, trying to communicate to someone other than his loving and wonderful nurse, Natalia, he finds Polina, this beautiful, doomed creature who awakens what was a cinder in Ivan into a full-blown fire. I don't want to spoil any aspect of this book, and I'm sure I could, as have, unfortunately, I think, in other opinions, some, in my opinion, other reviewers, but suffice it to say that you will have never read another work like this unless you spend your time reading a lot of dead guy stuff. and with that rambling introduction, welcome, Scott, and thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. This is an honor. I appreciate it.
Sure. So before I go off on my tangents, which I usually do, tell our listeners about the book and how such a strange subject, how Ivan came into your head.
So about 10 years ago, I saw this documentary called Chernobyl Heart. Have you ever seen it?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I have, actually.
Okay. All right. So you know, it's an extremely powerful graphic documentary. I actually won the Academy Award for Best Documentary Short in 2003. And I was absolutely haunted by it. It basically takes cameras into these hospitals, like the one that Ivan lives in southern Belarus, northern Ukraine. And it's filled with these kids that have all the same human urges and instincts and desires and goals and dreams as other human beings, but due to no fault of their own, like an inability to see them out, you know, to actualize them in the way that we kind of take for granted. It was over, and I felt haunted by it. And there's this sense of unfairness that kind of came with watching it. I started flirting with the idea of what it'd be like to give one of those kids a voice. What would that sound like? What would it sound like if you had been raised inside the walls of a hospital your entire life and you had no clear way of actualizing any of your goals and dreams? So this book is that experiment, is how do you create and explore that voice? And what does it say about our sense of humanity.
You know, having seen the documentary, and for me it's really close to the heart because all of my family, and I'm second generation, is from Chernobyl. They're all from Belarus. They're all from Vitebsk. And so...
No way. I did not know that. Huh.
And I always... Okay. I haven't gone back because I'm scared to go back. But because being Jewish, everything that I would have seen was destroyed in the pogroms, was destroyed in World War I, was destroyed in World War II. So I don't know what I would see. But in any event, talk some more about Ivan. I mean, this is a person who's living with people who are worse off than he is, both in terms of physical disabilities and the ability to actually cogitate. And so he is kind of isolated. Well, he is isolated, but for, as I said, his nurse. How did you, I mean, where did you find him? You know? Did he come?
Did he come? A couple answers.
Okay, go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's this cliche, right, that authors, you know, most characters that an author makes are 60% themselves, right? And to a large extent, that's true. It's probably a terrible idea for me to admit to the public, but I would say 60% of Ivan is me and how I would respond to those circumstances and my own set of insecurities and phobias. And to a large extent, right, I think this book is a metaphor for how human beings in general approach love and connection, right? How no matter how together you are, and how comfortable and confident you feel, most of us carry around these kind of images of being broken and maybe not completely worthy and deserving of love, right? And so Ivan's story in a big sense is kind of reminding us that just by being human, it is our birthright to be worthy of that. So obviously, largely Ivan is drawn from me and how I would feel I would react to that situation in those circumstances.
It's funny.
But beyond that, there's, you know, it's just part of the magic of writing, right? It's part of how I feel so grateful to be able to do this and to be, you know, moving in this direction with my life is, I don't know. You know, you say, where does it come from? To a large extent, there's this cool magic to writing where there's some place deep where this stuff just starts to flow when you get rolling. And I like the voice. I was charmed by it. I felt like there was this beautiful mix of being, you know, defensive and snarky and but also funny and also really sensitive and on some level truly connected with his emotions. Like there's this internal battle with him, right? Where on some level he's completely, you know, just a walking bag of defense mechanisms, and on some other level he's learned to actually touch those super vulnerable deep parts of himself, and I think largely because of what he's just experienced in the story.
When you talk about the magic of writing, it's like if you do read, and I encourage my readers, like it's going to take you 10 minutes to read the Siren story that I discussed. The cool thing about that is like when I was a kid, me and my brother would read Gogol's The Nose, and you know, the guy's shaving and his nose falls off, and then he sees him in the carriage driving by in this beautiful overcoat, and it's like we would laugh our asses off because it was just so impossible but so clearly possible. And in your story, it's like doesn't have the same humor, but it's evanescent, and it's like, yeah, you wake up with this sore and, you know, it's not this, it's not that, it's no big deal. And then it turns into something that's, oh my God. And it's like, but it's not, he just has these thoughts and he thinks there's a part of him that just thinks if he takes masking tape, you know, it's, so that, like, that's the magic of writing. To me, that, and then why did you switch from that short story kind of thing? Yeah, because this could have been a short story. So why did you switch from that to the novel? What made you tip over?
So you knew it was originally a short story?
Yeah, well, I didn't really know. I kind of intuited it.
Okay. Oh, wow. Okay. So, all right. So, yeah, that character was originally kind of idealized in a short story. And I knew I wanted to write. I knew I wanted to be a writer, but I hadn't quite, you know, felt the novel in me yet. So I had this collection of short stories. And I set it out to a bunch of people, and I got a response from a wonderful agent named Victoria Sanders, who's not only a great agent, but she's got a really great nose and vision for you know, for what would make good writing, right? So she says, you know, debut authors, they don't do collections of short stories. This won't sell. I will have a hard time selling this. But this particular story, would you be willing to like convert this into a novel? And when you're unpublished, You'd be like, yes, yep, I will do what you say. that's a great idea. And so, you know, with no commitment, and there's no formal commitment that he would represent me after writing it, I spent the next year of my life converting it. And it was beautiful to have that opportunity because, you know, I think it's a beautiful scaffold when you're writing your first novel to have a short story first, especially one that has the whole arc kind of worked out already. And so it gave me the opportunity to really just bring him to life, you know, fill in all those. Yeah.
Is it, and the thing about it is that you have to bring in things like Mikhail, the director, you know, you have to, that has to work properly. And what you did was, it's a tour de force, and which is also would be a big spoiler if I said what happened. Obviously, yeah. I wouldn't. But then Polina, would she have been part of the short story? Would there have been this truncated love story? Or did you say, you know, I can't just leave it be him. I have to add her into it. So when it started out, was she in it already?
Absolutely, yeah. She was still the core of the story.
Okay, got it.
Yeah, because, I mean, anything that is cathartic about his experience would not have happened without her, right?
Yeah, definitely.
She's ultimately the thing that wrenches his soul enough to get him in touch with himself.
Yeah, and it's really cool the way you did it, too. There's one scene in particular, again, which I won't discuss, where you could see the pivot of the relationship, and there's a physical aspect of it as well. But, yeah, it's really funny because when you're talking about 60% yourself, I remember if I was trying to go out with a girl or something, it was always this sidelong approach, and it generally dealt with insulting each other.
Right.
Which
right.
is basically all my relationships are like that.
There's something about that playful teasing, right? That builds rapport early on in a relationship. And it forces there to be some kind of mystery, right? You know, it's I guess they call it direct game when you immediately compliment somebody and you know, let the cat out of the bag that you're attracted, right? But if you're playful at first, there's kind of this fun mystery and this rapport building that happens before you're just like, I think you're attractive.
Yeah, it's like, you know, her response should be, or the other person's response should be, you're really weird, like, just leave me alone, okay?
Right.
And then that's, you know, creates a great relationship, especially if you can hang with it, which some people can. I mean, there's really nice people, you know, and they don't understand. I mean, the thing that's cool about it is you have to know when you walk up to somebody, okay, is this going to work with this person? Because if it doesn't work, they're going to be deeply insulted, you know?
Right, right, exactly. So you just play the odds and say, you know, regardless of the reaction, I'm gonna take it. I'm gonna handle it because I care. Because this is something that's important to me.
Yeah, you gotta have people, and you have to have the guts to go up and do it. You know, and and that's almost acquired. I think it sounds like from you, it sounds like both of us, it was acquired. I mean, we felt that way, but it's really hard to actually put it in action.
Right.
At least the first couple of times. But you know what's really funny, though, when, you know, we don't see Polina for a little bit, but when you think of Ivan, you know, first you're thinking, oh, wow, he's really witty, but he's kind of mean, and he's kind of, like, spiteful and malicious. But then you meet her, and you think, oh, this is angelic person. But it turns out she's even more of a burglar kind of thief kind of whatever than he could ever be. Well, obviously,
right.
Because of physical limitations. But yeah, you wouldn't have thought that. I didn't think that. How did she turn into that? How did she turn into such this beautiful, angelic person who also had this other side to her, you know?
Because isn't that real? You know, are any of us a perfect, beautiful, angelic individual? She would have been a bland, flat character if she was just this perfect thing who walked him through like a ghost from Christmas past or something that walked him through his life and, you know, showed him how to be himself. This is a young, you know, teenage girl who's struggling with something very, very awful. Actually, several very, very awful things without giving away too much, you know?
Right.
And there is no doubt there's going to be some trauma there. There's going to be some ways in which she approaches and deals with it. That make her feel a little bit more safe, right? And you know, so I don't think you mentioned in the introduction that it's leukemia, but I'll go ahead and say it's leukemia. There is this kind of classic reaction that people who have terminal cancer often have, which is kind of this tendency towards, not terrible, but mild abuse, you know, abusing your caregivers, because there is this kind of sense of control that you have around it, right? Whether or not they're conscious of it, or whether or not they want to be that way.
It's funny, you know, well, for a couple of things. First of all, when I think about it, now that we're talking, it's kind of like Romeo and Juliet. I mean, you have the 16, 17-year-old people. Their end is kind of whatever. But anyway, so, and also the other old-fashioned thing is it's kind of like, you know, Gulliver's Travels or something by Lawrence Stern or Anthony Trollope, the way you have this foreword and this epigraph that are clearly not what they appear to be. Yeah,
right.
And then I started looking up the names like James C. Begley and W.P. Kalish, but you made them up, so the only thing that comes
Absolutely.
Up is your book.
Yeah.
But listen to this. So James C. Begley was in the Korean War, and he died. He died in 1950, and he was hit by a missile.
Wow. No way.
Yeah, he was a corporal in the infantry. I like doing
that. Thank you for doing my research for me. I appreciate
that. So in case someone else ever brings that up.
So I'll just go ahead and say this. Those characters, those names were actually just fun ways to sneak friends of mine into the book.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's what I figured it was.
Yeah.
Well, so why did you do it in that kind of antiquated but really pleasant way, as if this is found? And it's the only thing that's kind of weird is found not where I thought it would be found, you know? So it's found there, but he's there, you know?
Right, right. So it's a hard question to answer without giving away, right? So, you know,
you can just tell me. Who cares who's listening? Just tell me in like veiled language.
Okay. So he's not always there, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the idea is that at some point after he left, there was another crew that came in and happened to find these papers either in his room or who knows where, right? And then they found the story compelling enough where they, you know, brought it back to the States.
And why did you do it that way? And also, why is it in the first person?
The story in general or the foreword?
The story in general.
Oh, so okay. So it's just in terms of a craft decision, why did I? Because just the intimacy of it. A story like this works so well when you feel like you're having a conversation with that character. In general, it's like, as much as there's some third person writing that I really love, the writing that really tears me up, that I really just truly fall in love with, tends to be first person because there's no space. Right, there's no space between you and that character and his thoughts and his feelings, and I feel like a lot of third person writing, while amazing and beautiful, like, you know, 100 Years of Solitude is one of my favorite books of all time. There's this cozy kind of space that that separates me a little bit from the writing. And so, why did I choose to have this format where you know? This is a collection of papers that have actually been discovered in real life, and I think even if you know it's not real, it tricks people into it feeling real. And you know, some of the feedback that I've gotten on early reviews is, you know, using this technique has drawn people in right away.
Oh yeah, definitely.
to the point where there's actually been a few readers, like I've read a few good reviews where they didn't get it. They actually thought that this was actually a true autobiography of one of these kids that lives in a hospital in Belarus.
Yeah, and that's the cool thing about doing it that way. But you don't see many modern books done that way, where it's as if the manuscript was found. That's why I was saying it's kind of old-fashioned, but kind of cool. And the other thing that's weird is that, okay, it's first person, but there's this guy who has his own universe, because he has a very limited access to the outside world. Because, and so we're living in his universe through his eyes. And then the second thing is, okay, for the reader, and like when you're done with this, you're giving it to the reader, it's up to the reader to work with it, decide what's happening and all that. So like for the reader, you got to go at the beginning, you go, wait a minute, is he a reliable narrator? You know,
right.
And you got to figure out, well, maybe this isn't what really happened because we don't have any perspective from which to gauge it other than perhaps Natalia, and she doesn't necessarily have to exist. But yeah, you have to decide, okay, I'm going to take him at his word. And that's always a kind of a quantum leap for a reader. But it's always nice when an author does that because it gives us work to do.
Thank you. Yeah, that's a huge compliment. I think with a character like Ivan, you can't help but believe him because there's nothing sanitized about what he says, right? He's so, you know, there's such a lack of social intelligence with him on some level, right? It's a kind of a theme throughout the book that he, you know, you grow up within these four walls with a, you know, a bunch of other mutants who don't have all their wits about them. You don't learn the same set of social skills, right? So much of what's funny and kind of witty about the writing is that he unintentionally says awful things that he doesn't even quite know are quite as awful as they are, you know? Talking about, not feeling all so bad when, you know, a girl died from picking the infection in her neck, right? And not realizing that's not something you share, right? Even if that is the case. So when all this, you know, when all this is said and done, he's, you know, kind of dark enough and flawed enough where you can't help but kind of believe him.
You know, it's funny because it reminds me, like, you know, he's such an but it's like reminds me of Social Network about Zuckerberg. When that first came out.
Yes.
And he's getting his deposition done, and the woman says to him, you're not an but you try so hard to be.
Yeah.
And that's what he seems like to me. And it's then he meets this person who's able. They both have swords and shields, right? Don't they?
Right. And right, they do.
That's what's so cool about it, because they joust for a long time, and then all of a sudden there's this shift, and they realize what they both mean to each other. And
yeah,
there's a real dynamic that you've created. I mean, and that's why I think that when I first read it and I thought, oh, this was at one point a really great short story, now it's a great novel, because you were able to, you know, kind of create this skein of, like, this web that wouldn't have been there otherwise. And so your editor, yes, is a genius.
Right. Agent, that wasn't even my editor. That was an agent who picked
your
it up
agent.
And was like, yeah.
Oh, yeah, right, your agent.
It's not their job. It's, you know, that's why I'm really impressed with her to have that kind of vision.
Oh, yeah, and I didn't even say, well, I did say, yeah, it was published a couple of days ago, and it was published by St. Martin's Press, which I should also mention the publishing company.
Right.
I know it's funny, in your biography you say, okay, when all this is too much, you take off and go surfing. When you go surfing, do thoughts arise? Do, you know, does some of this stuff come to the surface, no pun intended?
yeah, you nailed it, actually.
Really?
Yep. So surfing and bike riding especially, or just taking walks. I do most of my dreaming, in terms of, so my process is I write 500 words a day by hell or high water, and just a very difficult, because if the human mind, if you skip a day, then you just have to skip your next day. So by hell or high water, I do 500 words a day. And then the rest of the day is kind of dreaming and exploring stuff. And until there's this weird moment where, like, you just know, you feel it. You feel, okay, that's what's supposed to happen. That's right. That feels right. And that usually happens while surfing or bike riding.
What do you tell your kids when you're teaching them about this? Like, we're talking now about this process. So what do you tell those guys? Do you tell them the same thing, that you have to come up with a schedule? If you miss one day, it's like me working out. If I miss one day, all of a sudden 6 months later, I go, hey, I used to feel good, you know?
I think the focus with them is, okay, so I will say this. They've had this kind of this fun experience of sharing this with me, right? You know, so I was in the middle of a field trip when I got the call from my agent that you know, St. Martin's had picked up the book, and I was like, woo, right? And they're all, you know, totally stoked for me, totally happy. And And I feel the best part about them witnessing this is that there's this huge teachable moment where, you know, who am I? I'm a physics guy, you know, teaching high school, who on the side had this passion to write, and I kept a disciplined schedule, and I didn't have this like fixed mindset where I'm like, I can't write because I'm a physics and math guy. That I, you know, I worked my butt off for about, you know, 6 years in honing craft in order to get to this point. And that's the story that I usually share with them because, yeah, I mean, I'm somebody in their life. You know, it's one thing if, you know, J.K. Rowling or something says, you know, Harry Potter was rejected 13 times before someone accepted it. But it's another thing when, you know, you see someone in your life close to you and very real who, you know, just worked their butt off and actually made that happen.
Yeah, it's funny because when I read about you and read about the physics and all, which I love physics, I can kind of intuit things, but I can't work anything out. And that's why I'm so interested in the monks and physics. But it's funny because at the very end, let's see how I can do this. If you talk about letting the very bad things in, and you talk about if in the future, if this exists, then I'll be able to do this and I'll do it to you. If you talk about things like that, somehow, I don't know why, but that equates to physics with me. And I don't know why. But it's like,
interesting.
Yeah, you take, yeah, like when he says, and I'm not going to go any further, but like when he says, you know, just take it in and let them be there. Somehow that just, I don't know why it resonates as something that would be kind of quantum in nature. You know, the idea of observing something, changing, you know, like Heisenberg, like observing something and thereby changing what it is, that kind of thing. Yeah, actually, so I would think that like from time to time, depending on what kind of physics you do, that some of those thoughts, like when you read something by Arthur Eddington or something, and he's taking Einstein's theory of relativity and bringing it down to a level where even I can understand it, it's kind of like that. But I'm rambling again.
Yeah, no, you're not rambling. No, this is fun stuff to talk about. So that part in particular, when I talk about letting them all in, to me, that's a very Buddhist notion, right?
Completely.
So, and there's you know, I'm very inspired by Buddhism in general, and you know, especially Tibetan Buddhism. But there's definitely a few moments in the book where, you know, I think there's like little hidden Buddhas in the book. I think that that Nurse Natalia is a hidden Buddha. I think that Paulina, when she's at her best, she's a hidden Buddha for him, kind of like guiding this kind of process of catharsis for him. But the parts that I think are very physics-y, you know, and especially the parts where I feel like I'm 60% Ivan, are more like his tenets of Ivanism, right? Where, you know, he has this very strict mechanical understanding, almost like a spiritual understanding of the world.
Yeah, it's like, I think I would call Nurse Natalia a bodhisattva.
She's
more of that.
Right, yeah, good call.
You know, the thing about letting it in, I've never been able to do that. It's like if all your life there's a curb and you're walking across the street and there's a curb and you're afraid to go over the curb for some reason.
Yeah.
And then no matter how old you get, and I'm old, the older you get, it's like the curb's there and you're still afraid to go over it. And you know that if you just stepped over the curb, you'd be fine. But it's really hard to do that. And it becomes harder the longer you wait. It's like Hermann Hesse's Journey to the East or something. You know, it's like do it right away, because if you don't do it right away, you're probably not going to do it because it's going to get harder and harder.
Yeah, there's like a weird paradox in it, right? Because it is really hard. At the same time, it's as simple as a choice.
It's the easiest thing to do in the world. It's like Chung Yum Chung Pa. You know, it's like just let go of that little thingy. You know, if you're parachuting, just cut the cord. You know?
Right, right.
And
yeah, I feel like, especially in Eastern philosophy, this notion of letting go is one of the most overused and misunderstood notions, right? Because, you know, you can tell somebody to let go all you want, right? But how do you really let go? And I think one of the big misconceptions about meditation, too, is that it isn't about, you know, somehow removing all fear and anger or trauma or discontent. Like that's kind of impossible. You can't. You take away fear today and you're probably dead tomorrow, right? It is one of our best, most beautiful tools that we have, and there's a reason why we feel it all, right? And I think the pathology comes where, you know, we can live not the most fulfilling lives that we want to live because we let fear be a reason to not live vital life.
But you're right. I mean, it's like you can't tell. It's like telling someone who's depressed, which people have told me from time to time, why can't you just be happy? You know, it's like, well, because, you know, you can't even explain it. And it's like meditation is not like writing your 500 words a day. It's like some guy saying, do whatever you want. Like my brother's bumper sticker, nothing happens, you know, and people will say to me, oh, I can't meditate because all these thoughts will go through my head and then I'll be thinking about this and that. I said, yeah, okay, well, you know, sit down and breathe, and then when they come through, just let them out, you know, the usual stuff, but they say, no,
that
I can't.
That is the meditation.
Yeah.
Look at them, letting them be there.
Yeah.
And not running away for the first time.
Right, and also if someone says, well, I can't do it, you go, okay, fine. You know, there's no judgment of any kind.
Or yeah, absolutely.
I need to start meditating. That's my favorite. Or if you or me and vice versa, and I said, I think I'm going to write a novel. Well, you're not going to write one.
yeah. There's no thinking about it.
Right.
Yeah, so much life is just, it's simply a choice. Simply a choice. But a choice in spite of how you feel, right? You're right. It's the most frustrating thing in the world when somebody says, don't be depressed. Why are you depressed? You have so much to live for, right? We can't choose our emotions. You know, these things, they're part of what makes a human being. They're not choosable. What you can choose is to live a potent, vital life that you care about, that's meaningful, in spite of all that stuff that's inside of you, right? And I think that's a beautiful, it kind of culminates in the end of the story, in this kind of key decision that Ivan makes.
Oh, it's perfect. I mean, that one line, or that one word, right before he says, do you have a TV? She goes, it's 2005. Yeah, we all have TVs. And it's just one word, no. And it's like boldface and underlined. And then he makes he makes the choice that is the right choice. And I haven't said yet. It's really funny too. It's like she says, she says, you know, seatbelt. He goes, I only have one arm. And then she Good, it's not even just that. Then she sits and ponders for a moment. So it really is funny. And what really is funny against this backdrop of poignant pain is the fact that Polina and Ivan, basically their relationship is based on jokes, you know?
I'm sorry, it's based what?
On jokes. They're
Right. It has to. You know, it has to. I don't think you could survive on that kind of dreariness in that environment, you know?
And I wouldn't want to read it. I wouldn't want to read
that. Yeah, and you wouldn't want to read it. Exactly.
Yeah.
It's one of those weird cases where being realistic actually also makes it more readable, too. Sometimes being too realistic, right, makes a book boring, but in this case, not the case.
Yeah, and I'm always careful about spoilers, but there's lots of things I could say that would really show where the book pivots, but I won't do that. But the way you do it is really good because you do it like in a couple of sentences, or the one I'm not going to spoil, you do it and say, Polina makes one motion downward. And that's the best thing that could have ever happened in this person's life, you know?
Yeah. It's so interesting to me that I appreciate your focus on not trying to give spoilers and, you know, and ruin the ending and ruin the story. But in a very large way, the first sentence of the book gives away the ending.
That's true. I didn't even
think
that.
It's as far as that goes, I'm not too worried. There's a couple other reveals that I'd be real so upset with you if you gave them away, but that I think, yeah, if you feel the need to bring that up, don't worry about it.
Yeah, well, that's, good books, I think the first sentence should, or the epigraph should. you know, mm-hmm. or the cover can sometimes.
Yeah.
But it's, yeah, it's definitely, what made you decide to put the time clock essentially on Ivan's writing? You know, it's such and such a time I've been running for 77 hours. What made you decide to do that? Because it's such a device.
Yeah.
I've never seen it before.
Once again, it's two things I would say. One, there's a sense of immediacy about it. You know, I think it reminds you that this is happening in real time, right? It almost creates a sense of urgency. You know? And the second thing is that it fits his personality. You know, he's such a taxonomical kind of guy. Very specific, almost Asperger-y kind of
yeah.
specific about everything, right? And so him having that need to be very crystal clear down to the minute as to at which point he is in this catharsis, you know, is him, and it's sort of funny and creates that sense of urgency.
Yeah, and it's like, you know, he doesn't have Asperger's. It's not like he has Asperger's like someone gets it. His Asperger's is because of his position.
Exactly.
Yeah, and that's...
Yeah, it's almost like synthetic Asperger's as a
yeah.
result of this lack of social intelligence he's had to glean.
And he has no one to play off. Even Nurse Natalia can't play off his more intellectual concepts, although the room eventually that he... you know, is all fitted out for him. She's such a nice person.
Yeah.
She's such a nice, as opposed to the director who's like, ooh, pure, you know, pure evil.
Right, right.
That was
there's this purity to her that is beautiful. But even she, like, they can get kind of snarky with each other. It's one of those things where I don't know if I planned that in the beginning, that dynamic of that relationship. But
yeah.
It felt natural for them to kind of, there's moments when they bite at each other a little bit, but behind it, and I think it makes it so much more poignant, behind it there's such love. There's this just mutual respect and complete surrender to each other.
Yeah, she uses a cattle prod. You know, it's the cliche of, like, tough love. She does use a cattle prod
right.
from time to time, but you never lose sight of the fact that everything she's doing, and she's anticipated it. That's, again, goes back to the Bodhisattva thing. She's already anticipated everything that's going to happen, and she's just
right.
and she's patiently waiting for it, which is, you know, there's
yeah.
all, you know, you got all kinds of things going on, don't you?
Yeah, thanks. I hope so, and it's really fun to talk to someone like you about it because, you know,
because I read it.
You're true, cause, yeah. But even, you know, I have a lot of friends who, you know, kind of copy so far and read it, and I adore them for it. And I so appreciate that they have. But, you know, a lot of the weird, subtle stuff, you know, doesn't necessarily come out of those conversations. So this is a lot of fun.
Yeah, if you get going on Good Morning America or whatchamacallit, Fresh Air or something like that, you're not going to get someone who's spent... Well, you know, I read it in one sitting, too, which usually pisses me off with the author because... You know, I got all this stuff to do during the day, and then I start reading like at 9. So
yeah.
then I read it and finish it like at 2:00 in the morning, and I got to get up at 6 or 6:30. So then I get mad at you. And
oh,
it's like,
come on, that's sweet. Thank you.
But it's true though. It's like, oh, come on, give me a break, because I can't stop. And then, you know, and then it's early in the morning, and I get 2 hours of sleep, which is probably
that's the best compliment I can get.
It is.
Yeah.
And I don't mean it as a compliment, but you're right. And that's, I mean, if you have to, well, like you said, he sucks you in the beginning. And now I understand what you were saying about the first person. If it wasn't written in the first person, because you get inside his head right away, like you
right.
said about the first
exactly.
sentence. Yeah. Well,
go ahead.
I was just going to say, I mean, I can't say enough about it. And, you know, I own an independent bookstore, Wellington Square Bookshop, which is right here in Chester County. And
mm-hmm.
When this is, you know, this book will be on our front table. And, you know, I would love to promote it. And if you do go out on your tour, or maybe you already are, please come by our store and sign. And we can talk and go to dinner and have a drink or something. That'd be great.
I would love that. Yeah, it'd be really fun to flesh out this quantum physics and
oh yeah,
and stuff.
That would be great.
Impossible to answer in 60 seconds.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, and we don't have time to do that now, but I would love to talk about, you know, the way I the Dalai Lama's meeting each year with the quantum physicists and all that, and obviously the things that you know from your work with the monks, which is fascinating. So that could take up a whole other show. But
awesome.
Yeah, thanks so much for joining us today, and it's a great book, and I encourage everyone to read it.
Thank you so much, Sam. I really appreciate it. It's been a lot of fun.
We're talking with Scott Stambach. The Invisible Life of Ivan, or Ivan Issyenko. He says Ivan, which is the usual pronunciation. I always say Ivan for some reason. But in any event, it's a first novel. He's written some great short stories, as I said. You can go through some of these oddball periodicals, oddball in the sense that they're great. And the one I would recommend, and you can find it, all you got to do is let me find the story. It's called The Siren Disappeared. And it's a great short story, and it's a great introduction. I'd suggest reading that before you read the novel, and then read some of his other short stories. I'm trying to think of, it's in a periodical called Writing Disorder. So if you just Google Writing Disorder, Scott Stambach, or The Siren Disappeared, you can just download it. And Google, just put Reader's View on the left-hand side where they have this horizontal line. Just hit Reader's View, then there's no ads or pop-ups. You just get the text of the story. It's wonderful. Anyway, so yeah, he really wrote a great book, and it's his first book, and he's just a kid, as everyone is compared to me, but I really highly recommend it, The Invisible Life of Ivan Issyenko, and it was just published 3 days ago, so we will now have it on the front table, which is where I'm going to make everyone put it, and can't say enough about it. In any event, what do we got going on? We got upcoming is Patrick Flannery, who's going to discuss his latest novel, I Am No One, which is very similar to this in its oddness, weirdness. Hey, I've never read something like this before. And Jade Chang, who's going to discuss her highly anticipated debut novel, The Wangs Versus the World, which you can only imagine what it might be about, but it's really, really funny, really, really weird. The weird books are the ones I want to review. You know, those are the ones I want to talk to people about. So in any event, this last few weeks has been great, great authors, and the next couple of months we have pretty much everybody lined up. So it's going to be a good remainder of the summer and fall with regard to what you hear here on The Avid Reader.